caused quite a kerfuffle among New York City's literati. And the protesters became truculent as the riot police moved in with tear gas and pepper spray. Now, there is a hilarious story about the word truculent told by Al Michaels, the well-known sports announcer. And he was recalling an on-air interaction between Bob Uecker and Howard Cosell from the early 1980s. Bob Uecker, known as Uke to his friends and fans, was a retired catcher who became a much-loved sportscaster. And as many of you know, Howard Cosell was the bombastic, cocksure sports announcer who rubbed many interviewees and colleagues the wrong way and was known for his signature staccato delivery. And at the time of this on-air episode, Uecker was gently chiding Cosell for calling for a bunt when a bunt should never have been called for. Cosell, obviously peeved at Uke's mild rebuke, replied, Uke, you don't have to be so truculent. You do know what truculent means, don't you? And without missing a beat, Bob Uecker replied, of course, Howard. If you had a truck and I borrowed it, it would be a truculent. And speaking of trucks, I remember the word truculent by linking it to a somewhat harrowing experience that I had driving on I-81, a busy interstate that runs down the middle of Virginia's beautiful Shenandoah Valley. It was during a rainstorm, and there was a lot of traffic on the road. And suddenly, I heard the piercing sound of an 18-wheeler's horn, looked behind me, and saw a huge truck not just tailgating me, but right on my bumper. So I moved over into the right lane as quickly as I was able to. And as I did, I saw the irate truck driver gesticulating aggressively at me with the medial digit of his right hand. And as my dad would say, communicating to me that I was number one in his book. So, while truculent has nothing to do with trucks, I remember truculent because of this aggressively hostile truck driver. A vivid image and experience that has stuck with me. For our third target word related to aggressive behavior, imagine this situation. A high school teacher asks an unruly student to sit down and stop talking. And the student refuses. This time the teacher tells the student to sit down. The student looks right at the teacher, smiles, and keeps right on talking. What would you call this type of willfully obstinate behavior? This outright disobedience to authority? Well, English has a wonderful word for this, contumacious, our next target word. This student is showing her contumacious side. Contumacious is an adjective meaning stubbornly disobedient and rebellious to authority, willfully obstinate. Here's contumacious in context. The contumacious defendant was held in contempt of court for refusing to listen to the judge's orders. Now, as always, to remember contumacious, I invite you to make a personal connection. Think of someone you know, perhaps from your school days, or maybe someone you work with who stubbornly refuses to listen to or follow those in authority. This person thumbs their nose at authority and regulations and may even flout the law. Write this person's name down in your vocabulary notebook next to the word contumacious. Our fourth and final target word for this aggression section is the adjective rapacious. Now, rapacious doesn't just mean aggressive. It has the added connotation of greedy and grasping behavior. Rapacious means aggressively and excessively greedy or grasping, predatory. For example, the rapacious company bought up all of its smaller competitors until it had a monopoly on lollipops in North America. Synonyms for rapacious are ravenous, voracious, and avaricious. Use rapacious when you want to emphasize the greedy, devouring nature of aggression. Okay, so let's briefly review the four target words that we just learned. Bellicose, truculent, contumacious, and rapacious. I'll provide the definition, and you identify which of the four words it goes with. In addition to the definition, I'll also give you a little context for the word. Okay, definition. What would you call someone who is stubbornly disobedient and rebellious to authority? This word could describe that unruly student who won't listen to a teacher or someone who knowingly flouts the law. Answer? Contumacious. Next definition. What might you call someone who is aggressively greedy or predatory? This word might describe a real estate agent who goes to any lengths to get all the clients in his region, thus trying to devour the competition. Answer? Rapacious. Okay, next definition. This word is often used to describe someone who is cruel, brutal, and fierce. They're always looking for a fight. It's also often used to describe particularly scathing criticism. Answer? Truculent. Okay, final definition. This word means aggressively hostile, pugnacious. It is often used to describe nations that exhibit warlike and aggressive behavior. Answer? Bellicose. Ooh, man, that is enough hostility and aggression for one lecture, don't you think? So let's turn our attention to happier things. Let's have a little peace and quiet. Our first peaceful target word is halcyon. Now, you'll often hear halcyon used along with its collocates, days and times, in sentences like the following. The elders of the village often spoke wistfully of the halcyon days of their youth, before the dragon brought death and destruction. Or, the halcyon times of peace and prosperity were a mere memory for the old woman who had to flee her homeland before the war. Now, as you can see from the sentences, halcyon is an adjective that means tranquil, calm, and peaceful. It can also refer to happy, joyful, and prosperous times. Now, in Greek mythology, Alcyone was the daughter of Aeolus, god of the winds. She was turned into a bird, the halcyon, or kingfisher. Now, some ancients believe that the kingfisher brooded its eggs on a floating nest. Aeolus was said to calm the seas for a few days in winter so that the kingfisher could nest in peace. So note the second syllable sea in the word halcyon. Think of a peaceful sea with the halcyon bird tranquilly floating on its nest. This is a wonderful visual to help you remember the word halcyon. Next to the word halcyon in your vocabulary notebook, draw a picture of a bird nesting beside a peaceful, tranquil sea. And with that soothing image in your mind, let's take a look at another peaceful word. Now, I started practicing yoga about 5 years ago. I'd hurt my knee playing soccer, and my doctor recommended yoga as a wonderful, low-impact exercise that would bring a host of health benefits. Being your typical guy, I admit that I was a bit dubious. I mean, I wasn't interested in chanting a bunch of ohms with folks who were pliable enough to put their feet behind their ears. I mean, was I even going to get a workout? But after my first practice, I was hooked. Not only was this hot Ashtanga yoga a strenuous workout, I mean, there were actually a lot of triathletes in my class. But as the class went on, the chattering of the to-do list in my head began to subside. My stresses seemed to wash off me, and a feeling of serenity and tranquility began to wash over me. Exactly what a father of three needed. So yoga gave me a feeling of quiescence. And the adjective form of that noun is quiescent, our next target word. Quiescent is an adjective meaning tranquilly at rest, inactive, still, quiet, motionless. Let's listen to the noun form quiescence in context. After the children went to bed, the house settled into a quiescence that soothed the frayed nerves of the harried parents. Or in a more medical sense, quiescent can also mean in a state or period of inactivity or dormancy, such as in the back of his mind, he always knew that the quiescent tumor could start growing again at any moment. This is why he lived every day to the fullest. Okay, we're moving on from halcyon and quiescent to our third target word relating to peace, propitiate. Now, do you think propitiate means A, to enter into a serene state of mind, or B, to appease, to regain the favor of someone? Let's see if putting propitiate in context helps. To propitiate his wife after forgetting their anniversary, he bought her a 3-carat diamond ring, a trip to Paris, and to make full amends, did the dishes and laundry for an entire year. So if you said B, you're right. Propitiate is a verb that means to appease, to make favorably inclined, to regain the favor of someone. It's often used in religious contexts, as in, the priest propitiated the gods by sacrificing a fatted calf. So, when you propitiate someone, you're appeasing them. You're making peace with them. Synonyms for propitiate include mollify, dulcify, conciliate, and placate. Now, earlier in the lecture, I asked you to listen for the Latin root bel in words like belligerent and bellicose. So, let's do a similar exercise for peace. Listen to the following words and try to find a common root. Ready? Okay, here we go. Pacify, pacifier, pacifists, pacific. Did you hear the root PAC? The Latin root PAC means peace, which is the core meaning associated with those four words. Now, being a father of three, I've always liked the word pacifier as the key word for the PAC root. So note this in your vocabulary notebook. I mean, when you give a squalling baby a pacifier, what do you get? Peace and sleep, which for parents of newborns is pretty much the same thing, isn't it? Now, a common Latin phrase you'll encounter that includes a form of this root is the Pax Romana, or Roman peace, which refers to approximately 200 years of relative peace in the Roman Empire during the first 2 centuries CE. Okay, so let's review our 3 target words having to do with peace. Halcyon, quiescent, and propitiate. Which word would best describe the state of mind of a monk meditating in tranquil repose is trying to achieve? Halcyon, quiescence, or propitiate? If you said quiescence, you're right. Quiescence is the state of being still, quiet, at rest. Okay, which word best connects with the following situation? A student who, after failing to complete 3 homework assignments, leaves an apple on the teacher's desk in the hopes of regaining her favor. Is it halcyon or propitiate? If you said propitiate, you're correct. Propitiate means to try to regain the favor of someone, to try to appease them. And finally, would the following be an example of halcyon times? A released prisoner thinking back to their time in prison? Probably not. Halcyon means peaceful, tranquil, and joyous, words not usually associated with being locked up in the clink. And as I often do, I've saved my favorite target word of the day for the last, mollycoddle. Another fun word to say that just rolls off the tongue. Go ahead and say it with me, mollycoddle. Mollycoddle is another one of the great underused words in English. And with your help, we're going to bring it back into general circulation. Now, one of our themes today was aggression and cruelty. And the opposite of being aggressive is to nurture, to take care of, to pamper. But if you take this pampering too far, it becomes mollycoddling. So more formally, mollycoddle is a verb that means to overindulge, to treat with excessive attention to the point of spoiling someone. Let's put mollycoddle in context. The boy in the reform school remembered his halcyon days back at home when his mom would mollycoddle him, making his bed, doing his homework, and waiting on him hand and foot. Now, his truculent teachers reprimanded him cruelly for any behavior they deemed contumacious. Now, you can remember mollycoddle easily from its 2 parts, molly and coddle. Coddle means to indulge and pamper, to treat tenderly. And the molly part of mollycoddle was originally a term of contempt for a man who pampered himself too much. And this brings us to the end of our lecture. So, for the rest of your day, I want you to stay out of the way of any truculent truck drivers, bellicose bullies, and contumacious curmudgeons. And if you do, you'll be less likely to get into any sort of a hullabaloo, spat, or worse, Donnybrook. And at the day's end, I hope you arrive at a quiescent home with someone there to mollycoddle you. I mean, we all need to be spoiled now and then, right?
Lecture 6, Going Beyond Dictionary Meanings.
Welcome back. At this point in the course, we've already accomplished a lot. First, we've learned a number of rich target vocabulary words, such as factitious, mountebank, and Donnybrook. Second, we've also learned about how to learn vocabulary effectively. With our target words, we've applied the 5 core principles of effective vocabulary learning, starting with clear definitions, placing the words in rich context, making connections to the word, exploring the morphology of the word, and semantic chunking. Definition, context, connections, morphology, and semantic chunking. These 5 core principles are now powerful tools in your personal vocabulary toolkit. You own them now. And let's not forget about the vocabulary notebook itself. Don't worry if it doesn't look pretty or if it's not perfectly organized. I don't care about that. Just the very act of you physically writing down words and definitions and making connections will plant those words more solidly in your lexicon, your mental library of words. Now remember, with your vocabulary notebook, the process is just as valuable as the product. This is because the real vocabulary notebook, the one that we're after, is right up here, in your mind, not in a notebook or on a computer. So, with these vocabulary tools in mind, I've got 2 questions for you. First, how can you maintain and even deepen your knowledge of the vocabulary words that you've already learned in this course so that you don't lose them once we move on to the next lecture? So you don't forget those words 3 weeks, 3 months, or even 3 years from now. And second, how can you do it in a way that's engaging and doesn't take all day? Well, today I'm going to share some more engaging, effective ways to reinforce your vocabulary knowledge. And I want you to add these strategies to your vocabulary toolkit. I've chosen strategies that, once learned, take minutes, not hours. They'll give you a lot of bang for your learning buck. So let's start with learning the basic definition of a word. Now, when you were in school, how did you learn vocabulary? Did you look up the vocabulary definitions in a dictionary like me, copy them down, and try to write the newly learned words in a sentence? How'd that work for you? Let's take a look at what happens when someone has only definition-level knowledge of a word. I'm going to give you 3 examples of actual student sentences in which a surface definition level knowledge of a word was not quite enough. Now, these sentences are from a well-known vocabulary study done by researchers George Miller and Patricia Gildea. For each of the target words, I'm going to read the dictionary definition first. Then, I'm going to read the sentence the student wrote. Ready? A first word, correlate. Dictionary definition of correlate, to be related one to the other. Student sentence, me and my parents correlate, because without them, I wouldn't be here. Makes sense, they're related. Second word, meticulous. Dictionary definition of meticulous, very careful, too particular about small details. Student sentence, I was meticulous about falling off the cliff. I was careful. Third word, relegate. Dictionary definition of relegate? Send away. Student sentence? I relegated my pen pal's letter to her house. I sent it away. Now, these sentences are humorous, but I've shared them to make an important point. If you noticed, each of those sentences actually made sense if all you know about the word is the definition. So obviously, there's a lot more to really knowing a word and being able to use it than just knowing the definition. So why is that? So to answer, let's explore an important vocabulary concept, the iceberg metaphor. Now, what percentage of an iceberg do you think is above the water? What percent of the iceberg can you actually see? What do you think? 60%? 50? Do I hear 40? Well, the surprising answer is around 10%. Only about 10% of an iceberg is visible above sea level. So that means the vast majority of the iceberg's mass is below sea level. And this has led to the expression, the tip of the iceberg, to describe a problem that appears to be small on the surface, but which actually underneath is much more problematic than it initially looked. So what do icebergs have to do with learning vocabulary? Well, we've discussed before how a vocabulary word consists of a label for an underlying concept. When you learn the definition for a new word, you're just skimming the surface of the word's meaning. Now, a good, clear definition is a critical first step, but it's just the starting point in learning the concept. I want you to think of a dictionary definition as the tip of the iceberg, the beginning of learning the concept. What this means is that we've got to dig and dive deeper than the definition to really know a word so well that we can use it effortlessly in speaking and in writing. So for the rest of this lecture, I'll be introducing you to a number of additional strategies that you can use to dive deeper into word meanings. And the first strategy will focus on a way to help you remember the basic dictionary definitions. The other strategies will help you get beneath the surface of those definitions. Okay, so imagine that you've just learned a new word in this course, or you've just looked up a new word in the dictionary, but you're still having trouble remembering the word's basic definition. I mean, for some reason, it just won't stick. Does that sound familiar? I mean, so what can you do? Well, this is where mnemonic strategies come into play. Now, the word mnemonic is an adjective meaning intended to assist the memory. You've probably heard of mnemonic devices, which are learning techniques that help you remember information. Now, all mnemonics are based on the same learning principle, associating something you already know or something that's easy to remember, like an acronym, a phrase, or a rhyme, with something new that you're learning. There's that new to known connection again. Some familiar mnemonics include the phrase, "Please excuse my dear Aunt Sally," to remember the order of operations in math, parentheses, exponents, multiplication, division, addition, and subtraction. Or do you remember that acronym ROY GBIV to remember the sequence of colors in a rainbow? Now, our go-to mnemonic device for learning vocabulary definitions is the word-part-connection strategy. Now, this approach is also commonly referred to as the keyword method. However, because I don't want to confuse this with our keywords for each root, we're going to call it the word-part-connection strategy in this course. It's a simple but powerful three-step strategy. And here's how it works. First, read the target word out loud. Second, analyze that word. See if the target word or any part of the target word sort of pops out at you and reminds you of something else that you already know. And third, associate that something else with the target word's meaning. All right, let's try it out. For example, let's take the word castigate. Castigate is a verb meaning to punish, rebuke, or criticize severely. You might think of an angry teacher castigating an unruly student. Now I want you to visualize the word castigate and say it out loud with me. Castigate. Is there a word part that sort of jumps out at you? How about cast? I mean, how can we connect cast, meaning to throw or hurl something, with the meaning of criticizing severely? Well, if you're castigating someone, you're casting or throwing criticisms at them. That's a memorable image. So if you were to make this word part connection in your vocabulary notebook, you would circle or highlight cast and castigate, and you jot down the connection. But you might like visual images, and if so, you could draw a simple stick figure of a person with the figure's arm throwing or casting, and the words rebuke and criticism in the air, as if they're being cast or thrown. Now, if you prefer words to visual images, you could simply write down the connection in your own words, as in, when you castigate someone, you are casting punishments and criticisms. Let's try this word part connection strategy out with another word that you might not know as well. Toothsome. Now, do you know what toothsome means? What do you think? Do you think toothsome means A, toothy, as in a toothsome smile, or B, delicious or sexually attractive? Well, surprisingly to most, including me when I first learned this word, toothsome actually means B, delicious, as in a toothsome plate of spaghetti, or sexually attractive, as in he saw a toothsome woman walk into the room. So how can we remember toothsome means delicious or sexually attractive? Let's try the word part connection strategy again. First, let's say the word out loud. Toothsome. Second, let's find a word part that pops out at us. For toothsome, it's pretty obvious. Tooth. Now, how can a tooth help trigger the meaning of delicious or sexually attractive? Well, the delicious part's pretty easy. When we eat a delicious meal, what are we eating or chewing with? Our teeth. So when you see toothsome, visualize a mouthful of teeth eating a delicious meal. Maybe draw a picture of a mouth with teeth and jot down that toothsome equals teeth chewing a delicious meal. But how can we connect tooth to the second meaning of toothsome, sexually attractive or handsome? Well, what do models and good-looking folks like celebrities always do on TV? They smile a lot. And when they give us those big toothy grins, what do we see? Those perfectly straight, perfectly white teeth that have probably been artificially whitened, right? I mean, nobody's born with teeth that perfect. So you can highlight the tooth in toothsome and write tooth equals perfect toothy smiles of sexually attractive people. Okay, so let's put it all together in one image. I want you to picture a really good-looking, attractive person eating a delicious meal with their teeth taking center stage. And this will help you trigger the meaning of toothsome, which means delicious or sexually attractive. So just write this connection down in words, or if you want, sketch a picture, whichever works best for you. But not so fast. We actually did much more than just make a word part connection with toothsome. Now, when I was researching this word, I took a few seconds and I plugged toothsome into the wonderful resource that I use a lot, the Online Etymology Dictionary. And guess what I found out? Guess what the etymology of toothsome is? We were actually on the right track with the connection that we just made. Because you see, toothsome came into the English language in the, get this, 1550s from a combination of the word tooth and the suffix some. In toothsome, tooth was used in a figurative sense of appetite, liking, like a sweet tooth. Well, that makes sense, right? And some is a suffix meaning tending to, causing. So something that's toothsome causes appetite or liking. It's tasty and appetizing, like a delicious meal. And by extension, a person who looks good could be considered delicious looking, couldn't they? Toothsome. And what just happened right there is what you'll find when you use this word part connection strategy. When using word parts as a mnemonic device, there's a good chance you'll actually be digging down into the etymology of the word without even knowing it. So this toothsome example brings me back to the last point I want to make about mnemonic devices here. I believe the best mnemonic device for learning vocabulary is the one that English already has built into its linguistic DNA, the etymology and morphology, the history and structure of the words themselves. So whenever you learn a new word, remember to take a few moments and read beyond the definitions in the dictionary. Look at the etymological information that tells you the history and derivation of the word, including the roots and affixes from which the word's derived. For most words, this helps a lot. Okay, let's quickly review what we've learned so far. When learning the definition of a new word, particularly one of those words that just won't stick, use these two strategies in this order. First, see if the etymology and morphology of the word, including affixes and roots, helps you remember the definition. Like knowing that mal means bad or evil helps you remember that a malefactor is someone who does bad, evil things. Second, if the etymology or morphology doesn't help, use the word part connection strategy and develop your own mnemonic. Connect a part of the word that jumps out at you to something that helps you remember the word's definition. And remember, connecting to visual images can be particularly powerful. Okay, that's helpful for learning the definitions. But definitions alone don't lead to deep vocabulary knowledge. So after we've learned the definition, how can we go deeper so that we actually start using the words in speaking and writing? Well, one way to move beyond the dictionary definition is to use graphic organizers. Now, a graphic organizer is a tool you can use to visually map information about a concept. And our go-to graphic organizer for vocabulary words will be a variation of the four-square concept map, as described by literacy experts Stephen A. Stahl and William E. Nagy. I'm going to take you through the process of using and creating a four-square concept map with the target word captious. So if you can, in your vocabulary notebook, I want you to draw the four-square concept map along with me as I describe it. If not, just visualize it and try to draw it afterwards. Okay? So first, I want you to visualize a square. Now I want you to divide that square into four parts or quadrants. On the top of the square, write the target word, captious. C-A-P-T-I-O-U-S. Captious. In the top left quadrant, you write the definition and part of speech. Now, captious people are those annoying, nagging people who are constantly nitpicking at you and making a big deal over trivial defects and small issues. You know the type. It's the resident malcontent in your office. He is definitely a captious person. So in the top left quadrant of your four-square concept map, you might write the following dictionary definition. Captious is an adjective that means fault-finding, hypercritical, difficult to please. Okay, now imagine moving from the top left quadrant where we wrote the definition over to the top right quadrant. In the top right quadrant of a four-square concept map, you write synonyms and related words. And this is the perfect time to use a thesaurus. So for our example of captious, you might write some synonyms for captious that you already know quite well, such as finicky, hypercritical, crabby, cross, and testy. It's good to include synonyms that you already know, as these known words will serve to anchor your knowledge of the new word you're learning. Captious is related to crabby, cross, and testy. There's that new to known connection at work again. Now, you might also want to include some synonyms for the target word that you know a little, but you might want to use more. For captious, these might include carping, acrimonious, and cantankerous. All rich descriptive words that I don't use enough. How about you? And when you make an effort to use such words, you're moving them from your receptive to your expressive vocabulary. And just remember, improving your vocabulary isn't just about learning new words. It's also about dusting off those old ones you know, but don't use enough. Okay, so far in our four-square map, we've got the definition in the top left quadrant and rich synonyms in the top right quadrant. Let's now move to the bottom left quadrant of our four-square. In the bottom left corner, write down examples of the word. And this is where you make those personal connections. So what's a good example of a captious person in your own life? Who do you know who is fault-finding and nitpicking? Maybe a hypercritical aunt or uncle? A busy buddy at work? Maybe it's an English professor who loves to bleed red marker all over your essays? So write this person's name down as an example of captious. Finally, let's move to the bottom right quadrant of our four-square concept map, where we write down non-examples of the word. Why non-examples? Well, remember, to know what a concept is, it's often very helpful to know what it is not. So what's the opposite of a captious, fault-finding person? How about someone who's complimentary, encouraging, even flattering? I'd write my mom here. My mom is the most complimentary, encouraging person I know. She's my non-example of captious. You could also include the antonyms complimentary and encouraging in this quadrant. So once you get the hang of four-square concept maps, you can fill them out pretty quickly. They take a little bit of time, so don't feel that you have to use them with every single target word that we explore. Maybe choose one or two target words that grab you and try them out. I love four squares because they incorporate so many of the principles of vocabulary learning into a handy visual framework. And what if you want to add more information to your four square? Feel free to change it up. I mean, I am not a Procrustean teacher. Make it work for you. Make it a five or a six square. For me, I almost always add two more boxes, one for a picture of the word and one for morphology that includes the affixes and roots in a word. For example, let's say you're learning the word circumlocution. Now, circumlocution is a noun referring to evasive, long-winded rambling, indirect speaking. So how can we remember circumlocution? What word parts in circumlocution pop out at you? Well, circum means around, as in circle, and the L-O-C root means speak, as in elocution. So circumlocution literally means to speak around, in sort of a roundabout, indirect way. You could record circum and L-O-C in the morphology box and actually write the word circumlocution in a circle in the picture box. That's a great visual. So if you remember circumlocution this way, you won't forget it. So we learned the word part connection strategy and the four-square concept map. But what about those good old-fashioned standby flashcards? If you like flashcards, here's a few ways you can use them. First, you can go the traditional route, simply writing the word on one side of the index card and a definition on the other side. And you can review by looking at the word, reading it out loud, and seeing if you can articulate the definition in your own words. Then, check yourself by turning the card over. Or reverse it. Start with the definition side of the cards up and see if you can identify the target word from the definition. However, in my teaching career, I found that flashcards are a lot more effective if you include a lot more information on the back than just the definition. For example, many of my own students write a four-square concept map on the back of the index cards. This way, you got the word's definition, its synonyms and antonyms, and examples and non-examples of the word. And when reviewing each word, see if you can recite all of the information on the back of the card before checking yourself. That is one great way to dig deeper than just the definition. A lot of my students also draw memorable pictures or visuals on the back of their cards as memory aids. Or if it's a tricky word to pronounce, spell the word phonetically to help you remember how to say it. Now, how else can you use flashcards besides the traditional routine? Well, you can play a variation on one of my favorite games, Connect Two. Connect Two is a vocabulary activity developed by vocabulary researcher Camille Blackowitz. This is a great game that forces you to think deeply and flexibly about vocabulary words. Simply pick two cards out of the deck, or if you don't like flashcards, pick two words from your notebook and see if you can connect them in a sentence. For example, let's say you picked mountebank and imbroglio. If you remember, a mountebank is a flamboyant charlatan, a swindler who arrives in the town marketplace, mounts a bench, and tries to sell quack medicines and cures to an unsuspecting crowd. An imbroglio is a complicated, confused situation or bitter misunderstanding. So, you might connect mountebank and imbroglio in a sentence kind of like this. The mountebank swindled half the town out of their hard-earned savings, creating quite an imbroglio in the community that lasted weeks. Isn't that great? And it's such a simple idea. Connect Two encourages you to apply your word knowledge in speaking or writing while making deep connections among words. And if you're feeling a little bit cocky and want to challenge yourself, make it Connect Three or Connect Four. Now, if you don't like flashcards or don't feel you had the time to make them, don't worry. You can use the two-column note system we discussed in an earlier lecture. Target words in the left column, definitions, personal connections, pictures, morphology, or four-square concept maps in the right column. To review vocabulary with the two-column system, simply cover up the right column with a piece of paper so that you only see the target words in the left column. Then, you can review the target words in the same way as the flashcards, including the Connect Two activity. If you set up your vocabulary notebook this way, it does double duty as flashcard review. And finally, remember, words live in context, not on vocabulary lists or books. So if you need to actually use the words in context, you need to use them or you'll lose them. Here are two application activities that get you to actually use our target words. One activity is for writing, and the other is for speaking. So first, simply write the word in a sentence in your vocabulary notebook. If you write the word in a sentence, make it a sentence with enough rich context so that when you go back to read that sentence a week from now, it actually helps you remember the word. Now here's a big tip for this activity. Use example sentences from dictionaries as models. A lot of online dictionaries contain many wonderful usage examples. For the word captious that we learned today, you might write a sentence like this. His captious boss never complimented anyone. Instead, he tried to motivate his employees with hypercritical comments that highlighted every little mistake, fault, and error. Now notice what I've done in this sentence. I've couched the target word, captious, in a lot of rich context. I use the stereotype of the overcritical boss. I included the synonym hypercritical. And I included the related words, mistake, fault, and error. Boss, hypercritical, mistake, fault, error. All words related to captious that will lead me back to its meaning. And for our speaking activity, I got a challenge for you. Flanagan's Use It or Lose It One Word a Day Challenge. Every day, try to use one of our target words in a conversation. Now, it's helpful to prep for this. If it's a completely new word for you, I like to try the word out first in a low-pressure situation, like a family dinner or with some friends. After I pick the word, I try and plan how I might casually slide it into a conversation. For example, I might mention to my family at dinner, "Man, my captious new editor didn't have one positive comment about my chapter. He bled red ink everywhere." Yes, it might be a bit contrived. Yes, it might feel a bit weird. Yes, you might get some eye rolling from your friends. But I guarantee that you will remember that word, and you'll be more likely to use it again when you really need it. So let's finish today with an important principle I learned from Stephen Covey's The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Now I'm going to ask you a question, and I want you to be honest here. Raise your hand if you've ever crammed for a test in your life. Have you ever waited until the day before a major exam, pulled an all-nighter, sucked down Cokes and munched pizza while trying to cram a semester's worth of information into your brain, and then shuffled to the exam the next morning all bleary-eyed? Do you remember frantically trying to regurgitate everything that you learned into one of those exam blue books that college professors seem to love so much, and then promptly forgetting it all by the next day? You may have passed the exam, but did you learn? How much of that information do you remember today? Now I want to ask you another question. Imagine that you're a farmer. Could you cram on the farm like we all crammed for our exams? I mean, could you sit on your rear end and do nothing all spring and summer, wait until the day before the fall harvest and then quickly plant seeds, water them, and hope for a ton of sunlight, and then harvest the crop the next day? Cramming on the farm. It's pretty ridiculous, isn't it? If real farmers crammed like this, they'd never survive. So following Stephen Covey's lead, the point I want to make is this. Real, long-term learning that makes a difference, like farming, is a natural process that takes time. And you can't trick your way through a natural process. Cramming doesn't work. However, what does work with learning is doing a little bit every day. As my yoga teacher said to our class once, don't do a 3-hour session of yoga once per week. It's better to do 20 minutes a day, every day. So, don't do a lot a little. Do a little a lot. That's the law of the farm. So I don't want you to feel that you have to do all of the activities that I shared today. I don't want you to feel like after this lecture you have to stay up late creating flashcards or making a 4-square concept map for every word. But if you want to continue to deepen your knowledge of these words during the course or after the course is over, do this. Simply pick one target vocabulary word that's gotten into your bones, one that's grabbed you for some reason. Then pick one of the activities that I shared today and dig a little deeper into that word using the activity. Just a few minutes a day can make a big difference over a lifetime of vocabulary learning.
Lecture 7, Wicked Words.
According to the Irish political theorist and philosopher Edmund Burke, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. So just as there are many types and degrees of evil, there are many words in English to describe various aspects of wickedness. In this lecture, we're going to learn some of them. Now, also during this lecture, we'll be answering some vexing questions about wicked words, including, would you want to be called a snollygoster? Why or why not? And what's the difference between a venial sin and a venial sin? And which one do you have to confess? And finally, would a secret plot to overthrow a benevolent queen, a plot that slowly evolved over a number of years, be best described as invidious or insidious? Okay, let's dive right in with our first target word, malediction. Now, do you think a malediction is a really evil, particularly heinous addiction to a drug or behavior, or B, a curse? If you said B, a curse, you're right. A malediction is a noun referring to a curse, evil talk about someone, slander. Now, as we discussed in earlier lectures, a little knowledge of morphology, our language's meaning system, can help us better deduce and remember a word's meaning. So, let's isolate the first three letters of malediction. M-A-L. Mal. This prefix comes from the Latin word malus, and it means bad, badly, or evil. Now, my own children remember this prefix because of Maleficent, the name of the wicked, nasty queen in Sleeping Beauty. Now, the second part of the word malediction is diction. And we know that diction can refer to the distinctiveness of pronunciation in speech. In fact, the Latin root D-I-C or D-I-C-T means speak, generating words like dictate, speaking or telling someone what to write, and dictator, one who speaks, telling you what to do. So, if you attach the Latin prefix mal, meaning evil, to the Latin root dict, meaning speak, you get evil speech, a curse. And if you remember malediction, evil speech, a curse, this way, you won't soon forget it. And you won't have to look it up again the next time that you encounter it. Now, the counterpoint to mal is another Latin root, B-E-N-E. B-E-N-E simply means good or well. So, a benediction is literally good speech, an expression of good wishes, often referring to a short blessing given by an officiating minister at the end of a religious service. Benediction and malediction are antonyms, good speech versus evil speech. Okay, let's put malediction in context. During the trial, the two litigants heaped maledictions upon each other as the judge rapped the gavel on his desk and called for order. Now, our key word for mal is malfunction, meaning to function badly or to stop functioning. Now, as we learned in past lectures, keywords like malfunction are words that you already know. And they're useful because they'll help you unlock the meaning of and remember many other words that you don't know or that you may not be as familiar with, but that are derived from the same root, in this case, mal. So, how many English words do you think contain the prefix mal? Well, there are many, many such words. But for now, I've identified a list of 16 rich vocabulary words that contain mal, meaning bad or evil. So let's go through this list together, beginning with 10 words that you're probably already familiar with. Okay, ready? Here we go. Malfunction. That's our keyword. Malpractice. Maladjusted. Malodorous. Now, the suffix O-U-S is a good high-utility suffix to remember. It means possessing, full of. So, malodorous literally means full of evil odor. Whew! Which is a great word to describe my teenage son's bedroom when he hasn't done his wash for a week and we roll him out of bed in the morning. Malodorous. And then we've got malign, malignant, malevolent, malice, malaise, and malware. Now, let's look at 6 more words that occur somewhat less frequently and as a result may be less familiar to you. Malcontent, maladroit, malinger, malefactor, malediction, our first target word, and malfeasance. Pretty amazing, isn't it? From just one prefix, we generate 16 rich vocabulary words, all having something to do with bad, badly, or evil. So we like to say when you learn one word, you actually learn 10, or in Mal's case, 16. Once again, a little morphological knowledge goes a long way. Now, let's begin by examining some of the more frequently occurring words in the first part of our list. And we'll do this fairly quickly, as these words are probably more familiar words to you. Malign. The first word on our mal list is malign, most often used as a verb, which means to speak evil of, to say harmful things that are untrue, to slander. The newspaper reporter unfairly maligned a woman of honor and distinction. Now, in a later lecture, we'll devote considerably more time to words like malign that refer to all sorts of verbal attacks, such as philippic and calumniate. Now, why is there a silent G in malign? This is another great example of the spelling-meaning connection we discussed back in Lecture 2. If we didn't spell malign with a silent G, we would lose the visual clue that malign is related to our next word on the mal list, malignant, a word in which the G is sounded. And malignant is an adjective that means dangerous or harmful. Think, a malignant tumor is cancerous, as opposed to a benign tumor. That's non-cancerous. And by the way, there's that Latin root, B-E-N-E, meaning good, in benign. Now, word pairs like malignant and malign, in which one word contains a silent letter, and a related word contains that same letter, but it's sounded, are word pairs that are common in English. We call them silent-sounded consonant pairs. And we'll be encountering other silent-sounded consonant pairs in this course. And your knowledge of the spelling-meaning connection can help you figure out and remember their meanings. Now, two more related mal words are malevolent and malice. Now, malevolent is an adjective meaning evil, harmful, or wishing evil or harm. And malice is a noun meaning a desire to injure or harm another. The witch in Snow White was malevolent and full of malice. And did you ever wonder why the witch in Sleeping Beauty is named Maleficent? If you read the story, you know, like my children, you know Maleficent means doing evil or harm. And what about that word malware? Now, just recently, some malware snuck its way into my computer and caused so many problems, I had to turn it into our IT department. And even they couldn't find it and fix it, so they had to re-image my entire computer. So, I've had a personal encounter with the evil of malware. Now, malware only made its way into our language fairly recently. And malware is a fantastic example of how we are still creating words today using the word formation processes of generative vocabulary, combining Latin and Greek affixes, roots, and base words to generate new words. So imagine that you didn't know the word malware. I mean, how could you remember it? Do you remember a related word strategy? When looking at a word that you don't know, it's often helpful to think of related words that are spelled the same or a similar word that you do know. So if you didn't know the word malware, you might think of a related word that you did know, like software. So, if software refers to programs used to direct the operation of a computer, then you can figure out what malware is, literally evil software, or software intended to do harm to a computer, like a computer virus. Okay, now let's move on to the six words on the mal list that most people find more challenging. These next six words will be target words. You may be familiar with them, but perhaps you don't use them as fluently while speaking or writing. So we'll take a little bit longer with these words. For our second target word, I want you to imagine this. You're at the office, leaving a meeting, and the same bellyacher starts to whine again. You know who I'm talking about. He's the office sourpuss, the chronic complainer, the prophet of doom and gloom. This person's always squawking, grumbling, moaning, and carping about anything and everything. I mean, nothing's ever good enough. If it's a sunny day, they complain about forgetting to bring the sunblock. There's a useful mal word for this person that you may know, but may not use. A malcontent. Now, what word or word parts pop out at you in malcontent? Well, we already know the prefix mal, so the other part is content. A malcontent is someone who is badly contented. They're just never satisfied. And more formally, A malcontent is a noun referring to a person who's chronically dissatisfied. Malcontents are chronic grumblers. Now, you'll also encounter malcontent used in the sense of a political rebel, someone who's active in opposition to an established government. So to remember malcontent, make a connection to a chronic kvetcher and write this person's name down in your vocabulary notebook the next time you see the word malcontent. Refer to that person as a malcontent the next time you're talking about them. But make sure the malcontent's not there unless you want to risk being maligned by the malcontent or risk his malice and malevolence. Now, another great synonym that I love for a complaining whiner like this is a kvetcher, one who kvetches. To kvetch is to gripe, to complain habitually. I just love this word because it sounds like what it means. Kvetch. Say it with me. Kvetch. 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 You can just feel the waves of dissatisfaction billowing out from this kvetch, can't you? Kvetch is one of those many wonderful Americanisms that came from Yiddish, literally meaning to squeeze, pinch, or press. So now visualize yourself being squeezed, pressed in by the constant complaints of this malcontent. Can you picture it? Malcontents kvetch a lot. Don't hang around them. They'll suck the life right out of you. Okay, we're moving on from malcontents to our next mal-target word, which is malaise. Now, some people think of malaise as a bad disease, but this isn't precisely what it means. Malaise is a noun referring to a vague or indefinite feeling of unease or discomfort. You might experience malaise at the onset of a flu. You're feeling a little general discomfort, but you can't really put your finger on what's wrong, can you? An easy way to remember this word is by morphological analysis, breaking the word down by its meaningful parts. Now, we know that mal means bad, but what about the A-I-S-E, A's? Well, A's is actually related to the English word ease. Again, the spelling-meaning connection helps us here, as the word part A's and the actual word ease in English look similar. So, malaise is the condition of being ill at ease. If you think of the word this way, you're not likely to forget it. And you'll see the phrase economic malaise often used to refer to an economy that is stagnant or in recession, an economy that is in a holding pattern or slightly losing ground. Such an economy probably reflects the fact that consumers, businesses, and investors may be vaguely ill at ease about the future. Okay, our next mal target word is maladroit. Now, someone who is adroit is skilled, agile, and clever, resourceful. You can be adroit physically, like a dancer, or skilled in other areas, such as an adroit politician who is clever and resourceful in working the system to further his or her agenda. Now, thousands of words have been and continue to be created in our language by combining prefixes, suffixes, roots, and base words. And maladroit is a perfect example. Just add the prefix mal to adroit and voila, we get maladroit, an adjective meaning badly skilled or badly agile. In other words, awkward, clumsy, tactless, bungling. Now, when I see maladroit, I think of a great story about my wife's Uncle Joe, a lawyer that has become a hilarious story in our family history. So during a trial in a hot courtroom, he split his pants, unbeknownst to everyone there. And to cover up the split in his pants, he donned a trench coat for the remainder of that day. It was the only thing he had available that would cover up the split. Now, he got stares from the rest of the day from the jury, the judge, and the opposing counsel as he made motions and arguments, sweating profusely in his trench coat in that stuffy courtroom. Now, Uncle Joe is known as an outstanding lawyer who's won many cases, but he's also become known for some maladroit maneuvers and misadventures like this one. So to really remember the word maladroit, take a moment to make your own connection. Think of someone you know who was maladroit in some way, or perhaps an instance in your own life when you may not have been as adroit, as skilled, or as clever as you would have liked. Write this connection down in your vocabulary notebook. All right, for our next mouth target word, imagine this. It has been a terrible morning. As you're leaving another dreaded meeting at work, the office malcontent starts kvetching to you about who got the corner office. A maladroit colleague accidentally spills a cappuccino on your new alligator skin dress shoes, and you begin to feel a malaise spread over you, a vague feeling of discomfort that you can't really put your finger on, but you think you've got shingles. Then, just when you think this malfunctioning office couldn't get any worse, you notice a colleague pickpocket the boss and slip away with her cell phone. And you yell, "Stop that, malefactor!" at the top of your lungs. Malefactor, our fifth target word, is a noun referring to a criminal, a person who violates the law. Look at the three parts of malefactor to help you remember it. The mal, the F-A-C, and the O-R at the end. Now, mal means evil. And we know from lecture two that the FAC root in the middle of malefactor means make or do. As for the or ending in malefactor, that's another high utility suffix worth remembering. OR indicates agency or someone who acts. Other agency words that include or are doctor, author, mayor, and editor. Write that down in your vocabulary notebook. So, a malefactor is literally someone who does evil. Now, we often remember words better if we contrast them with their opposites. In this case, you may be able to remember this word because it is the opposite of benefactor. Remember our prefix B-E-N-E, meaning good? So, a benefactor does good, like a patron or supporter. Other lively words for malefactors include criminals, scoundrels, scalawags, I love that one, knaves, cads, desperados, and scofflaws. Don't you just love these wicked words? Now use scofflaw if you want to emphasize people who ignore the law. This is a good one to call your acquaintances who avoid paying parking tickets. Now reprobates are also malefactors. Specifically, reprobates are evildoers who are utterly depraved and unprincipled. Think of the related word reprove. You would reprove a reprobate. And a final archaic and fun word to say is snollygoster, a shrewd, unprincipled person. Most people have never heard of this word. So, if you want to call a malefactor at your office something, but don't want them to know what it means, call them a snollygoster instead, and you should be safe. And this answers our question from the beginning of this lecture. You would not want someone else to call you a snollygoster. So, what do snollygosters, scofflaws, cads, scalawags, and other malefactors do? They engage in malfeasance, or illegal or harmful acts. Malfeasance is another great mal word. Malfeasance is a noun that means an illegal or harmful act, usually committed by a public official, that violates the public trust. Now here's a sentence that puts this word in context. The politician's malfeasance brought an end to his political career. Okay, for our next target word, I'll tell you a true story from my childhood that I'm still a little ashamed of, even after all these years. Now, I usually enjoyed school, but I must confess one time in third grade when I tried to bamboozle my own mother. For some reason I can't remember, I desperately wanted to stay home that day. So I lied to my mom, telling her that I felt sick. She put the thermometer under my tongue, told me to hold it there for a minute or so, and she left the room. And at that moment, I hatched my plan. I secretly took the thermometer out and touched it to the nearby light bulb in the hopes of falsely increasing my temperature, hoodwinking my mom, and staying home from school. I confess, I was a malingerer. I malingered. I was engaged in malingering. Malinger is a verb meaning to fake or exaggerate illness, usually to avoid work. Unfortunately, I was not a very adroit malingerer. In fact, I was a terribly maladroit malingerer, as my mom caught me red-handed with the thermometer still on the light bulb. Not only did I have to go to school that day, but I was punished for malingering when I returned home. Now, malinger is related to our mal root indirectly through the French word malingre, meaning sickly. Perhaps as a child, you malingered in an effort to stay home from school or to avoid your chores. You may have encountered a chronic malingerer at some point in your career. Come to think of it, maybe we should put the office malingerer in the same cubicle with the office malcontent and the office malefactor. I mean, that would be quite a good office space, wouldn't it? Full of malice and very likely a titch of malfeasance.